This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Patreon Tipsters. You can become a Blotter Presents Patreon Tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, the episode.
Suddenly, all of the trade secret stuff made sense. Oh, I see. It's not a trade secret. It's a different kind of secret. And,
Yet another Theranos-related true crime property hit HBO on Monday, Alex Gibney's The Inventor. Stephanie Green is back to examine the mystery of why we find the rise and fall of Theranos and founder Elizabeth Holmes so compelling across three different media. Later, Children of the Snow tries to examine the mystery of the 1970s child murders in Oakland County, Michigan, and we try to crack the case of a miniseries that should have been better than it was. Welcome to the Lower Register. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 89. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that reviews true crime properties. Not true crime itself. Crime is bad. That's why we call it crime and not cookies. Here to discuss one of the more fascinating crooks of the last few years is non-dropout, non-con artist Stan Fortean. Stephanie Early Green. Hello again, Stephanie.
Thank you for that title.
I mean,
I feel like you do now, especially with the college admission scandal, you have to be like, I actually didn't cheat my way into Stanford or swindle anyone post Stanford. So,
oh God, I know.
Just to place myself in a separate category than everyone else.
I must say that I was truly shocked, not by anything in the scandal itself, because sigh, but that Princeton was not implicated anywhere in that.
Oh, just wait. I'm really sure there's another dude who's
Yeah, there's a secondary or tertiary cover-up happening, I'm sure. Worst. Ugh, all right. Anyway. Well, speaking of scams, let's get into it. Okay, so The Inventor, as we're recording this, it still has not aired yet, but as you're listening to this, it will have aired Monday on HBO and ceaseless times on various HBO platforms in the meantime. I can't imagine that anyone listening to this needs the case file on Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes, but just in case, investors and the media hyped Theranos as a breakthrough in the large blood testing market where the U.S. diagnostic lab industry posts annual sales of over $70 billion. Founded by then 19-year-old Stanford dropout Elizabeth Holmes in the aughts, Theranos claimed its technology was revolutionary and that its tests required only about 1/100th to 1/1000th of the amount of blood that would ordinarily be needed and cost far less than existing tests. Great idea in theory. In practice, the technology pretty much literally never worked. But Holmes's ability to charm rich old dudes, then pack her board with them to keep the venture capital flowing, pretty much never flagged. From Going Clear and Enron, the smartest guy in the room director Alex Gibney, comes the latest deep dive into ersatz baritone Elizabeth Holmes's scam and whether she ever, quote, meant well. Okay, this is the third medium in which I've consumed this story. I am still not sick of it, but I did have some notes for The Inventor. Stephanie, overall, what did you think of The Inventor, the movie that we just watched?
Well, so it's totally watchable. I like, just because the story is so good, it's kind of hard to make a boring property about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I mean, because it's so bonkers. You don't even have to embroider much to get to some really crazy crap right off the bat. And now we've done, so we've listened to The Dropout and we've both read Bad Blood. And this is the first thing where we're actually seeing the actual people involved. So that added another layer of interest for me to this puzzle. And I honestly, I felt like, you know, this documentary, just any documentary about this could have been twice as long and I still would have, you know, found it interesting. But I'm not really here for the cheesy interstitials of old-timey movies and magicians and all that stuff. Like, that didn't add anything for me. Like, it didn't make this a more slick documentary, which I think they thought it did. I think they thought they were being really clever and artistic. I would have preferred them to cut away some of that and just keep it more streamlined.
Yeah, I agree. I did think that it was interesting that, you know, she named one of her machines the Edison, and then they had a sequence about actual Thomas Edison and how a lot of his whole brand, not that they called it that back then, was faking it till you make it and just like stalling investors until he could get it to work.
I had no idea about that.
No, I didn't either. The difference, of course, is that eventually he did get it to work. And I think this had no shot at ever working. But I did think it was worth doing in a visual medium just because there's something about, like, there's her weird voice, and we will get into that and her in a second, but there's also like even the way that she walks, and there's a whole lot of footage of her just sort of like visiting the troops, as it were, like in the lab and looking extremely uncomfortable in a very new, just out of the package lab coat. And even the way she walks is so studied and like off a little bit.
Yeah.
But with all that said, like overall, I wanted this to be both longer because I felt like there were aspects of this story and this con that they never really dug into, like her relationship with Sonny Balwani, like the spending that she was doing on her own security. Like they touched on the paranoia, but I felt like that was a whole episode of a limited series, honestly. But at the same time, a lot of time was kind of wasted on, like you said, nothing burger visuals. And also some of the narration was really like a bit much. I have a clip, and when we're done, maybe you want to tell me who your theory is on who is narrating this, because I couldn't track down a name. Here's clip two.
In the deserted property she designed, you can almost hear the echoes of her ambition and see how glass walls promising transparency could become a labyrinth of mirrors. Was Elizabeth lost in a landscape between what she could make real and the world of make-believe?
Okay, a few things about this, the first of which is calm down. The second is it sounds like that, like at times it sounded like Alec Baldwin to me. Sometimes it sounded like Michael Murphy, who is the guy who does some American Experience narration, and he was in Manhattan. So that was bugging me. I'm sure this information is out now on IMDb.
I was like, maybe it's the guy who does the Pure Michigan commercials.
Maybe.
Is it Daniel Stern? Like, that's always my guess when you don't know who the narrator is.
Or like, is it slightly Canadian? It could be a Sutherland. Just depends.
Oh, a Sutherland.
I don't think this is a Sutherland, but that's like my default. Like when they're telling you sort of like this, you know, secret about orange juice, it's like, that sounds like a Sutherland. Mm-hmm. Here's the third thing, which ties into kind of larger questions about this documentary. And there was a very good interview in The Guardian with the director, Alex Gibney, which I will link to in the show notes, but there was the sense that the Guardian interviewer thought he had been too easy on Elizabeth Holmes or too willing to sort of lean into an interpretation of her in this situation that was she meant well and got in over her head.
Yeah.
And that narration, which is from pretty early in the documentary, kind of made me feel like, not that the documentary is taking a position on, you know, her like relative guilt, given that she really was maybe trying to do good at some point. Like the documentary is welcome to take a position or any position. I don't need things to be an objective transcript. But I also think that it's really not clear what her motivations were and also don't matter past like 2009.
Right.
Like how she started out is no longer pertinent. Like past a certain point, it was definitely like
not an active fraud. Yeah.
It was a scheme. Exactly.
I agree.
So yeah, I'd be interested, listeners, if you want to check out that article and, you know, if you've watched the documentary and you feel like they, like the documentary feels a certain way, that is more sympathetic to her than we do, which how could you not be more sympathetic to her?
Yeah, it's a low bar.
Then we are, yes, we have a whole sequence of clips in which she's being fucking unbearable. Let's listen to them now.
Let's do it.
Oh God. The first one, in the first one, she's, I believe this is from the Fortune magazine, author's tapes, Roger Parloff, I believe his name is. We heard from him at the top of the episode, and he clearly feels like has been sort of emotionally destroyed by having helped her, you know, be on the cover and perpetrate this fraud. This clip is from, I believe, an interview with him, and he's sort of pressing her on the Steve Jobs thing. Let's have a listen.
You wear black outfits a lot. Why?
Because in line with the designing my life to be able to give every bit of energy I have to this, I have a closet that has a very large number of the exact same set of clothes, and every single day I put the same thing on and I don't have to think about it.
Steve Jobs used to say that too.
He wore jeans.
It's the he wore jeans that like kills me, that she's like, oh, but no, I didn't gank this affectation off of.
Well, she already had that response just teed up, you know?
Yeah. And it just, the whole thing is just so, it's so contrived. That it's like, well, what makes me look like a genius who's too busy to care about fashion things? And I mean, I don't know if you want to play a couple of the clips that you pulled on the same topic first, but I wanted to talk to you about how you feel as a sort of like, I feel like I ding her a lot for stuff that is understandable for a woman in this environment to like try to do, even if it's misguided, to try to do to be taken seriously.
Yeah. I mean, I get it.
I mean, she's an asshole and I'm happy to call her out on that, but there is a little teeny part of me that's like, I guess I understand what she's doing with the baritone. Like, my voice is obviously not a problem in this regard, but I get it.
I get it to some extent, but like, I have such a low tolerance for people just being fakers. Like, I mean, and just her arrogance and her trying to build up this picture of herself as this, like, I think you used the word wunderkind in one of our email exchanges. It's just so precious. And I just,
yes.
Ugh. I just, there's a clip I had, not clip, but I had pointed out to you that I don't think we're going to play, but where she's talking about how in high school she was so studious and she didn't have time to socialize because her best friends were books. And I'm like,
oh God,
please
yes.
just shut your pie hole for once. It's like, you know what? I went to the exact same university you did, except I actually graduated and I watched a ton of TV in high school. And cause she was saying she didn't watch TV, you know, she was just reading books. I'm like, shut up, lady. Like, she's just so obnoxious. Like, you know, and I feel like I know lots of people like this, have met them throughout the years, and I just find them icky and annoying. And that's my main impression of her. And yeah, I get that you're trying to position yourself as this female leader in a male dominated industry. But I think there are ways to do that where you're more authentic. And even in 2000, whatever, if you're inventing this new frontier in technology and you're striking out on your own, you should be able to do that in a way that's not so affected and borrowed from like Steve Jobs and every other, you know, tech leader that has ever existed. You know, do something that's like true to yourself, you know?
Yeah. Well, and on top of that, there's the feeling that this part of her like personal legend and brand building came first, even before the blood testing and the nanotainer.
Yeah.
And whatever else, just because there's also a sequence in which they show the story about her uncle like morphing and being perfected mm-hmm. as her inspiration. But we didn't clip it, but I'm totally with you on the TV thing. And I think I said in an email, like, I wrote my Princeton application in front of A-Team reruns.
Yeah.
Is A. B, I wasn't allowed to watch TV until, like, that wasn't approved until I was like 13. And I became a TV critic. So that's what happens. Like, it's completely out of balance and forbidden fruity. And you should just let your kids watch maybe some TV.
Yeah.
Anyway, the next clip that we have in our lineup is her humble bragging to an all hands. Do you have any other lead up comments to that?
Notes, I have. Exhibit A of why I would hate to work at this company and hate to be around this person, even in a non-professional context.
There are some pretty amazing two shots of the other people in the all hands trying to adopt bland expressions instead
trying
of
not to
actively
roll their eyes.
Rolling their eyes.
Yeah, strenuously.
I had no such compunction. Here's clip four.
I want to talk for just a minute about what it means to be in this company right now. I was sitting yesterday with the president of Brazil for lunch, and this woman had invited me and Eric Schmidt from Google and Mark Zuckerberg and the Airbnb guys and the Uber guys and a bunch of other people. And she sits down at the table with all these people, and we all have the headphones on, translators, and she says, "The strategic priority of Brazil is to get access to low-cost diagnostics that can facilitate early detection and prevention." And we're all kind of sitting there, and you can see like all the other CEOs' faces being like now wanting to be the ones in the spotlight. And she kept on doing this for like an hour and a half. And so, of course, I'm trying to, you know, be humble, but I'm...
Were you?
No.
I mean, did that even happen?
Who knows?
Doubt it. Yeah, exactly. I think this is one of the things that keeps me sort of coming back to the story in all of its iterations, is that there are certain things that we're just never going to know about her and about what really happened and about what she knew or didn't know and when, that she's never going to admit. She's just going to be in depositions like, "I don't recall, I don't know exactly." And there's that like unsolvedness to it
mm-hmm.
that is fascinating to me. And there's also this she's not hateful, but she really is affected in a try hard in this way that like I despise it, but also can't get enough of it.
Yeah. From a distance, it's completely fascinating. But if you had to interact with this person, I mean, how would you even stop your slapping hands from doing their job?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like I could not interact with this woman and be polite. I don't think, I would find it really difficult. I mean, for an extended period of time, because yikes, she's just awful.
Yeah. And it just went on for so long.
Yeah.
And the just willingness of really everyone, but in particular, rich guys of a certain age and in a certain media coverage lane. Like again, Jim Cramer being like, "Let's give her a chance to defend herself." Like she's had a decade.
Yeah.
Is that necessary? And here's my sort of favorite thing about this is that a professor who basically was like, "You don't know what you're doing, and this isn't possible, so I'm going to find you a new advisor."
The medical school professor.
Yes, Phyllis Gardner.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah. here's a clip in which she is referring with no small amount of asperity to what exactly continued to fuel Theranos despite the technology never having functioned properly.
The truth is that none of these people were really in a position to know what...
To judge, because they didn't have the qualifications.
No, no.
She didn't really want scientific input from what I could determine. Engineering, a bit more, because she was inventing an engineering device, but not medicine. She aligned herself with very powerful older men who seemed to succumb to a certain charm. And those powerful men could influence people in the government, influence the Department of Defense.
When I asked her, was this all about getting government contracts? She danced around my questions about that.
Everything that we're doing, yeah, may go into certain work we do for the military, which we really couldn't put on the record. Well, off the record, we were doing some work for the military, which we can talk about off the record.
Why is that? Why would that be off the record?
Because it can't be substantiated. And excuse me, but the clip we heard earlier, I believe, was her interview with Ken Auletta.
Yes.
In The New Yorker.
Yes.
But that's, you know, you've got like 50 or 60 something mainstream media white guy reporters who, these guys are like names and good at their jobs in theory, and in practice I think they just kind of didn't push her because they also wanted, you know, they also wanted this to be true, possibly more than she did. So I guess that's the answer in part to how this continued for so long. It's not just that she couldn't admit that it was not happening. It's that everybody who backed her play and put her on the cover also was not prepared to be like, she's full of it.
It's this snowball effect of idiocy, really. I mean, it starts with the venture capitalists or the early investors, like how they talked about this in the documentary, how the investors really rely on their gut, right? Like they don't actually do due diligence. They're just like, I have a good feeling about this. And they throw their money
behind. Welcome to finance. This is how Donald Trump still exists.
Yeah. And then that lends credibility to the enterprise once you have a certain amount of capital. And then everyone else just fell under her spell without anyone ever researching whether this company was actually doing what it said it was doing. To me, I just still can't wrap my mind around that fully. I know that's how it works and it happens every day, but like, it just seemed like such a massive oversight on so many people's part, you know?
Yeah. And then it turns into ass covering.
Yes.
And like, there's John Carreyrou like out on a skinny limb being like, I'm not afraid of David Boies, and like, this doesn't do anything.
Yeah. God bless
and
John
then,
Carreyrou,
yeah,
by the way.
But we will have, yes, truly. And we will have a snapshot in the visual aids, which will be on the podcast social media, about like the most understated headline in Wall Street Journal history. It's like, Theranos is struggling with some of its blood tests. Like, that is one way of putting it.
Yeah.
You had another clip involving Archimedes. Would you like to introduce that to us?
Yeah, this is Channing Robertson. Someone talking about how Channing Robertson was completely under her spell. And just, I just thought this clip was emblematic of how people were so hoodwinked by her, or like charmed by her, that they drew ludicrous parallels between her and all of these like historical like geniuses. And it's just funny. So
it really, yeah. Here we go. Clip six.
Channing Robinson, the head of the science department at Stanford, leaves his tenure position to work for her.
He just thought this woman was something special, you know, gazing into her eyes and realizing that he was talking to the next Steve Jobs or Bill Gates. There were some other names mentioned during the course of our conversation, like Archimedes.
Archimedes, like, come on.
I know.
It's just crazy.
It really is crazy. And then it just feeds on itself.
Yes.
And then, and now we're seeing now we're seeing it also feeding on itself, like, on the other side, that, you know, the this, like, dead cat bounce of interest in this story.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is a great, it really is a great story, but it's also, I think that sometimes, and the documentary does do a good job of this, if maybe somewhat belatedly in the runtime, getting into the fact that this was actually, like, this was fraudulent because it was dangerous. Like, it was fraudulent because it was making claims about medical test results that were wrong.
Yes. Like, that could have had huge impacts on people's health.
Yeah, that it's like, never mind, like, oh, well, we actually have to use, we actually have to draw blood from a vein in a more traditional way, like leaving out the nanotainer part of it. And also, mm-hmm. I hate the word nanotainer.
Yeah, it's obnoxious.
It's stupid and annoying. But also, like, well, we have a clip about this and the effects on, like, the infectious disease testing. But I think you had a similar clip before that involving
It's a clip of Ken Auletta questioning Elizabeth about how many tests their technology could actually run. Because I think he suspected, like, maybe this isn't all it's cracked up to be. And just her dissembling, basically.
Yeah, he there's some time spent on his characterization of her description of how it actually works as comically vague.
Yeah.
And this, I think, is related to that. Here's clip 7.
The truth is that before my story came out, there had already been instances of people going in to get their blood checked and they would need to do a venipuncture instead of a finger stick of capillary blood. And so I asked about that a number of times, and the answers were incredibly opaque.
So my question is, what percentage of your tests are needle rather than finger prick?
I don't have a really good number for you because it's changing. Yeah, and we're really confident being able to say that we're very close to 99% being on capillary, but when you try to pinpoint a number...
Are we talking about in the next 5 years, 1 year? 2 months?
Much less than a year, without question.
Yeah, well, someone should have had a question.
Yeah, she's just lying. I mean, that was just straight up lying.
Yeah, well, yeah. And that's... that it's like, oh, well, I don't have an exact number for you because it's on such a rapid increase. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this sort of in the second hour of the documentary, I think it pushes a little harder on the negative impacts of this fraud. The next clip is a little long, but I wanted to include it just because of the sort of breadth of, like, what it meant, and also that it's Tyler Schultz talking at the end. Poor Tyler Schultz. About the spread of a certain sexually transmitted infection.
Okay.
Here's clip 8.
Solution at some point was, you know, if you just throw out that one data point, then the other three look beautiful. And, you know, that's not the way you approach science that's going to be impacting people's lives.
There were people who had to run tests on devices that they knew weren't working and give those results to patients. People were very upset, you know, crying.
Some members of the CLIA lab would even have to call patients and tell them that they had to go to the emergency room because the lab test was, you know, so far off.
What really hit home for me is we were starting to do more infectious disease, hepatitis C, prostate cancer, and even syphilis.
I was running precision testing for syphilis, and there was a lot of variability in the test, but Theranos said, this is safe to use on real patient samples. And I was kind of blown away. If 100 people who had syphilis came and got tested on the Theranos devices, we would only tell 65 of them that they had syphilis, and we would tell the other 35, you're healthy, no need for medical intervention. So if people are testing themselves for syphilis using Theranos, there's gonna be a lot more syphilis in this world.
I mean, it's sort of like a funny button line, but, like, if syphilis isn't treated, it'll kill you.
Yep.
Like, a lot of things that are not treated will kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Treatments for things that you don't have will kill you.
Yeah, or cause you such undue stress that you have a heart attack or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, and then she's just sort of like, oh, no, it's fine. The military is totally using it. And the sad thing is, I think the military totally wanted to use it. And James Mattis totally tried to overrule the Pentagon, who was like, no, 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 we need to do independent testing. We're the Pentagon.
Right.
And she's like, nah. And I mean, good for the Pentagon, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, like my sort of net response to this is that to this entire documentary is it's like a B+.
Yeah.
I really like Alex Gibney's work. I just wish he had a little more time. Like I didn't necessarily need the deep dive on her childhood.
Nope.
Again, because I'm not sure it's relevant or like probative. And I think that I read Bad Blood already and I'm all set. I think it's worthwhile to have a visual of her and of other things. But it didn't feel too sympathetic to her necessarily. And I did enjoy the talking heads with the behavioral economist. Did you enjoy that guy?
Yeah.
I wanted to go get his book after talking about
it. Yeah. Do you remember what it was called? Because I don't.
I don't. And I'm not
sure.
What's
his face? He's French, right?
Yes. Also, I would like him to read the book to me because he has this musical way of.
Yeah. Ariely. Is that his name?
I think so.
Dan Ariely, something like that. Yeah. He's.
Yeah.
Good.
I enjoyed that. I didn't think it was like fluffy pop psych and didn't belong there, but I also wanted kind of more, I wanted more numbers. Like I've been saying since the beginning, I kind of want to like drop Marcus Lemonis into a time machine and send him back to this company and just have him looking at the camera speechlessly and then swearing a lot. I just would be amused by that. But yeah, if someone does a limited series for like AMC, I will watch that too.
Totally.
I just think this story is amazing.
Well, I was thinking this would be so much better as a mini series.
I think so too.
You know, just because you'd have more time, and then each episode you could delve into like a different, like less explored area of this wacky story.
Yeah, that it's like the early years, the second round of funding, Paranoia Estates, whatever. I will totally watch anything about this. We do have one more clip that I think sort of wraps it up. Any comments before we hear it?
Just that this is Tyler Schultz, George Schultz's beleaguered grandson, talking about... within Theranos, the carpeted world versus the tiled world, which I thought was a really interesting way of explaining how the company sort of the left hand purposely didn't know what the right hand was doing.
Yeah, I agree. I'm glad you asked for this clip, and here it is.
When I think of Theranos, I really feel like there were two entirely different worlds. There was the carpeted world, and there was the tiled world. And the carpeted world was where Elizabeth was a goddess. Everyone, you know, almost worshipped the ground she walked on. She could do no wrong. She was the next Steve Jobs. Theranos was changing the world. And then you go onto the tile side and nothing works. We're on a sinking ship. Everything's a lie. Reconciling the differences between those two worlds was really hard for me to do. I knew Elizabeth personally from all these interactions through my family. So I really trusted her. I believed in her. I would leave the tiled world thinking, oh man, sinking ship. And I would go have one conversation with Elizabeth.
Theranos was founded with the goal of creating a more actionable experience. If you can begin to understand your body.
And I would be so motivated to go back and work. And I felt like I was changing the world again. And I would go back into the tile world and I would go, wait, what just happened? You want it to be true so badly. And even for me, I was working with these devices every single day, and she could still kind of convince me.
It's that last quote that really got to me about this. Like, first of all, I thought carpeted world versus tiled world was a really good way of putting it, and I felt like I really understood what it was like to work there, and especially for him. But I think this is what always gets to me, is that I don't feel like she would be that personally compelling and convincing to me.
Apparently she was. I don't know. I don't think so either, like just looking at her, but...
But she must be, you know, what's funny, like they always put, they didn't use as many clips from this conversation as these properties tend to. But there's that conversation that like Chautauqua she had with Bill Clinton.
Oh, yeah.
And that always sort of makes me laugh because my dad, like, is, you know, is a Reagan Republican and sort of still calls him Slick Willie and hated him all along.
Yeah.
And,
my parents do.
Like physically ran into him at some golf event, like turned a corner too quickly in the clubhouse and like crashed into him. This is after he'd left office. And the Secret Service sort of like in their non-disguisey polo shirts sort of like appear to make sure everything's okay. And Bill Clinton was like super nice about it. And my dad came home and like could not shut up. Apparently about how magnetic he was and how nice he was, and they walked out to the da-da-da, and my mother is telling me this story. I'm like, are you like, can you put dad on, because I don't believe this. And
so
she's
weird.
Like, no, he's busy writing Mr. Dave Clinton on his Trapper Keeper. And that just makes me think of like, there must just be something about her in person that is much more magnetic and charismatic than, because this just looks like complete horseshit to me and to you. So she must have had something.
That visual of her and Bill Clinton together, that doesn't age well. Let's just say that.
No, no.
Given what really, we now know about both of those people, it's like, ew, you know?
It really doesn't. My dad was not correct about Reagan, I don't feel, but he had Slick Willie's number, mm-hmm. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
For a while, and then Bill Clinton put a pin on my dad's twin set. Now they're going steady. Oh my god, it was so funny.
That is really funny. But some people have that magnetism, and they end up being leaders, and sometimes cult leaders, sometimes political leaders, sometimes business leaders, and you know, it's that charismatic personality thing that you just, either you have it or you don't.
Well, and also can tip over into sociopathy, I think. Like, I'm not a doctor, but there is a higher than normal correlation. And there is a fair bit of time spent in The Inventor on Elizabeth Holmes not blinking.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I just wonder if, like, she understands human interactions the way you and I do. I would suspect no.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes, great story. This is a completely worthwhile 2 hours. I just wish it had been longer. Like, I wished that it had gone deeper into things so that it would be longer, because I'm obsessed with the story.
Same. Can I make one more comment? That's something that's been bothering me since we've been listening to these clips. You know how the background music is like, and I was trying to figure out what that was, and I'm like, oh my god, it's a theremin. Do you think that was intentional, that they picked a theremin to back the
Theranos?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't
know. It
was
just really bothering me, and then I was like, what is that thing called where it's like has dials? Oh, it's a theremin. Anyway, just food for thought. I'm just saying, just yet another layer of like preciousness of this documentary that they didn't need.
The other thing that I can never get past is, why is it so close to Thanatos? Like, I'm sure nobody else really clocks this, but like, could you maybe take another step away from the Greek word for death? I feel like that would be a smart idea for your...
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
For your business, but what do I know? I just have a little podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, let us move on then to our cold case. It's not actually that cold, because Children of the Snow did air last month in February on Investigation Discovery. And no, it's not a pun on the title, Children of the Snow. This was a two-part, very mini series, although each part, I think, was 2 hours of TV time.
Yep.
It's on the Investigation Discovery website. If you'd like to watch it, we will have a link in the show notes. Here is a partial case file from the ID website. In 1976, the first of four children is abducted and murdered in the suburbs of Detroit. After more than 30 years, the families of the four murdered children and Detroiters like J. Reuben Appleman are determined to find the Oakland County child killer. I will also add that apparently this ties into a bonkers, like, disadvantaged youth camp that was run as a child pornography ring.
Unbelievable.
In not the Upper Peninsula, like a island.
Between.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were interested in this because of the geographic locale. Do you want to talk a little bit about
I grew up in Oakland County, Michigan, which is where all these murders took place. And in fact, Timothy King, I think he was the fourth kid who disappeared. He disappeared from my hometown, Birmingham, Michigan. I found it really interesting to see all the locations where these kids got snatched up from, because that's where I grew up. Like Royal Oak, Michigan, like that's where my best friend from high school now lives. Ferndale.
Yeah, there were some drone shots that I was like, I think that's my uncle's house. Yeah. He's in Bloomfield Hills, but
Hills is also in Oakland County. It's right next to Birmingham. So Berkeley, that's where my high school had all of its like home meets for cross country races. So like, you know, like the kid who was snatched up from Royal Oak, he was like biking up Woodward, which is a big artery that runs from basically the border with Canada north for like 20 miles to Pontiac, Michigan. And I used to like do that. I used to ride my bike on Woodward. Like, I don't think my mom would be psyched if I was doing that at night, but I did bike all by myself all the time in this area when I was a kid. But when I was growing up, it was like 15 to 20 years after these crimes took place. So I guess the like terror of letting your kids bike around and stuff wasn't like a thing anymore by the time I was growing up in the 90s. So it was, for me, it was really interesting because these were like pretty much the only like hometown murders that I was even aware of growing up. So, and everyone knew about them, but it wasn't like we were scared in the 90s, you know?
Right. I think that this had glimmers of being really solid and good and affecting, but that our sort of Virgil into this case is the aforementioned J. Reuben Appleman,
yeah,
crazy wall sporting hipster doofus. Is a problem. Uh-huh. Like, there was a woman who was sort of like, I think came from the internet. Like, she's a journalist. Her name is Maggie something.
I don't remember.
She was in the more recent Maura Murray documentary on Oxygen or ID, and then she came on Crime Writers On recently.
Oh,
like, she's
the tattooed lady.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Like, she's fine, but, like, the way that she's used by the production, there's just too much going on in this production.
Yeah.
I felt.
They could have definitely cut the J. Reuben Appleman bit, because his connection to the case was he claims that he was almost abducted by this murderer.
Right.
And he got away, so that he has an interest in the case, which is fine, but I was much more interested in hearing from the families of the victims than from him, you know?
I was more interested in that, and I was more interested in, like, they got a lot of
the law enforcement,
who were involved, you're talking about various towns and jurisdictions, and I think one kid, his body was left, like, over the county line, like, by 6 feet in Wayne County, and they have a lot of interesting things to say. And also, they have a lot of insight into how, before the internet, it was both harder and somehow in a weird way easier for child abductors and child killers to operate. But then the production inevitably goes right back to either Appleman or just kind of undercuts itself with the sort of like unhelpful talking head filler comment that you get in all of these things. I have a few clips. in the first clip, this is like good information about how pedophiles communicated in the 70s and 80s before the internet that is then like gainsaid by Appleman and by a level of like a voiceover narration that like take one thing off Children of the Snow. Anyway, yeah. Here's clip 10.
The police also know that in the 1970s, before the internet, pedophiles ran in groups.
There was hundreds of these pedophile rings, and they all knew each other. They didn't have the luxury of cell phones and computers to communicate with each other, but they knew where to meet, and if they traveled, they knew how to connect with pedophiles in different cities. And so the rings were just unbelievably organized.
There was an atmosphere of fear. The wanted posters for the alleged Oakland County child killer were everywhere. They were scotch taped to light posts. They were plastered in the windows of the dry cleaning stores. Every kid was terrified. It was what we were told to be.
Did I also mention the insane music? Like, is this Grand Theft Auto 8, J. Reuben Appleman? Like, also, we know what everywhere means. It's just frustrating. Like, yeah. Not that I mean, I want to know more is not exactly accurate because it's fucking pedophile rings of the 70s. Barf. But, that's information that I don't have versus what it must have been like to grow up in this environment. Like, I'm older than you and I remember to an extent that sense of, like, a crackdown after Eitan Peetz disappeared.
Yeah.
Even though we were like miles away in the suburbs and that happened in Manhattan, it was like, I mean, these things would change life for you when you were a kid of sort of a similar age. But it's just frustrating that like you actually have access to good, insightful information about these kinds of cases, and then you just add this like by numbers production value to it that doesn't help.
Yeah, I was so gobsmacked by the specifics of this, the way this particular pedophile ring operated. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. Like, it was so crazy. Because it wasn't only the pedophile rings that were operating mostly within Detroit, where they'd like prey on vulnerable kids who like were poor and would like offer them food and money and stuff to have sex with men, basically. But also this whole thing where they had the boys camp on an island where they'd, you know, get, parents of children at risk to send their kids to this like boot camp, basically in the middle of frickin' nowhere, Northern Michigan, and then would just abuse these kids with like zero oversight year after year, summer after summer. It was batshit crazy. Like, I couldn't believe that was real, but it was. And then when they started zeroing in on the people who were running this thing, they like fled the country and they never got them.
And then there's all sorts of connections to like high up executives
business.
At General Motors.
Yep.
And it's like, okay, like you really can't make this shit up. If you did make it up, it would be like, all right, settle down.
It's like too
Season
much.
18
yeah.
of True Detective. That's way too much. Like, just, it doesn't have to be that elaborate.
And
I was actually talking in, the brief that came out earlier this week about this series Manhunt, this British series, and how like it's a serial killer case, but it's just like, it's not like crazy. There's not like dead drop notes to the press. It's not a huge conspiracy. It's just a guy killing people and they just solve the case. And then to watch this, it's like, oh my God, but this actually existed. Mm-hmm. It's bonkers.
And the villains involved were so comically villainous. Like, one of them was
yes.
a children's magician and gym teacher slash pedophile.
Like, oh.
Like, you can't, it's like John Wayne Gacy, you know, like you can't.
And I think I said out loud while I was watching it, like, and I assume he's also a clown at children's parties. And then the next line was like, he was a clown at children's parties. I'm like, oh,
yeah, of course
my
he
God.
Was. And the way he got some of his victims was by like getting children to be his assistant, like magicians. And then he'd abuse them. Like, what the fuck? Sorry, but it's like horrible. Horrible, horrible.
It's just, yeah. But then the production also, we spend in the, I only watched the first segment.
They're very
so
long.
Far. They spend an extended amount of time with one of the survivors of clown magic gym teacher guy.
Yeah.
And it's not that that testimony isn't worthwhile. And it's not that it doesn't, you know, give us information about the case. Like if the show feels its mandate, so to say, is to solve the case, you know, that's relevant. Mm-hmm. And I think the guy has to like work through some things, and I hope that he did that. It seemed like he was more distressed at the end of his time on camera than
they brought
at the
him
beginning,
back to the island where he was abused. I mean, it was sort of like,
yeah,
yikes.
But yeah, but it's also like, I don't know. Like, I also thought that the families, like you said, had a lot to say that was good and important that the show didn't trust them to just say how they felt and communicate to us what this was like. I mean, I don't think you can communicate what it's like because it's not like anything to go through that, thank God. But here's clip 11. It's sort of another illustration of my frustration with the show not understanding what its strengths are.
Here's this all-American family walking into a Catholic church to bury Tim. And then a little casket. I mean, it's just unbelievably heart-wrenching.
I haven't been to church in 35, 39 years. And none of my family goes to church anymore.
Why don't you go to church anymore?
I made a deal with God and he didn't live up to it.
When did you make that deal with God?
When Tim was missing.
Can you tell me about what that deal
was? I don't want to.
He doesn't have to.
No.
It's completely self-evident.
Yeah. Like, let my son be okay, and God didn't do that, and yeah.
Yeah, like, when did you make this deal with God? In fourth grade after a math test? When the fuck do you think? Ugh,
so annoying.
It's just so frustrating.
Oh, side note, that church where Timothy King was buried, that was my church, Holy Name, Catholic parish. When they showed it, I'm like, oh, there's my church that I went to growing up. Like, it's so weird. Like, this is just a weird thing, you know, for me watching it.
Yeah. I can imagine.
Yeah.
I keep hoping there were a couple of abductions in a sort of wildlife preserve that's down the hill from my parents' house that I grew up in, where they still live. It was when I was like two, and no one ever really talked about it, but I think it would actually be a good subject for one of these.
Yeah.
But this would be exactly what would be happening, that I'd be like, well, I'm being carried along by like, oh, it's Glenside Avenue.
Yeah.
Like, there's Natal's Donuts. Why is this so bad?
Yeah.
This is a good story.
I think I would have, I was just very engaged because all the locations were so familiar to me. But yeah, I think, but I can still see the flaws in this production for sure. I mean, yeah, they had so much potential.
I mean, this is what's frustrating to me the last couple of years about Investigation Discovery is that I think they are sort of going towards a more thoughtful and not so like batch processed way of making their shows.
Yeah.
And it's not so like, it's not so cheesy and it's not so campy. They're being a little more serious and taking their own output more seriously. But there's still that need because it's a, you know, basic cable channel that has to obey certain act breaks and like ad concerns that it can just feel not quite there. And especially Appleman, like, I'm not saying that he has nothing to offer, but unfortunately this whole thing really, I think, could have been 3 hours instead of four or even two, honestly. and needed to take this sort of vade mecum figure out of it, because we spend several scenes with him like restating his bona fides, and I just don't.
Yeah.
It's just frustrating. Here's our last clip.
When I really committed to the investigation, I knew that I had to go back to Detroit. I had been gone for about 15 years. I knew I had to get really deep into it by talking to the people that were touched by the case, walking those streets where the kids were abducted.
This is a pet peeve of mine, the let's revisit where this took place.
Yeah.
When there's absolutely no evidentiary point.
No.
In doing that, it's just this, like,
and he's not even a central figure of the case. Like, you know, he's not going to remember anything, you know, or add anything by going back.
Yeah. And like, sure, go back, but
we don't need to
then spend the time while you're back there sort of finding a way audiovisually to explain to us how close you actually were to being abducted by this same guy or group of guys.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can kind of follow you into the case. But instead, it just seems like he pitched this to Investigation Discovery and they made the show, and he's like the little Microsoft Office paperclip. Like, everyone turns that off immediately. Why? We do. I'm being super mean to old Jay Rubes. And, you know, I think this was a good idea. If I'm right, and that's how it went down, he pitched it, and then he's like, well, I want to be a part of this investigation, and here's 500 pages of my investigation on Reddit so far. Like, good for you. It's a fascinating story. I just kind of want to turn it over to Amy Berg or Aaron Lee Carr or someone else who either can make it for Netflix or can make it a little less this.
Yeah.
And use him and his research and his investigation into the case in a way that's a little less Reddit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing.
Yeah, I was
like,
getting
no offense, Reddit. I know you get shit done, but you know what I mean.
Yes.
I just feel like there's a lot
it's
of
the armchair
these that
detective
go from...
thing. It's like Missing Maura Murray vibes, and I don't need that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
you of all people,
no.
Do not need that.
No. Don't.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, it was fine, and I think for other, like, locals, people who grew up in that area, it's like worth watching at least the first part, but I don't think I'm gonna follow up.
No, I
the second part
either.
Is on my DVR. I don't think I'm gonna follow up.
Yeah, I don't blame
I
you.
I mean, it's fine. Investigation Discovery's efforts to be less Wives with Knivesy about their output is admirable, and I think sometimes surprisingly successful.
Yeah,
but this is not quite. For the time spent, it's not quite there.
Yes.
For me.
Should have been shorter. Less Appleman.
So.
60% less Appleman.
Yes, an Appleman a day is much too much Appleman. All right, speaking of less Appleman, Stephanie, where else can listeners find you and your Appleman free?
You can find me on my blog, StephanieEarlyGreen.com, and I'm on Twitter at Eteffi, E-T-E-F-F-I.
Thank you so much for revisiting Elizabeth Holmes with me.
Anytime. And,
yeah, I'm sure we have not heard the last of her. So when that Jennifer Lawrence scripted movie comes out, you will have to return to talk about that.
Oh, I'm so here.
As well. All right, folks, coming up on The Blotter Presents, Tara Ariano gets caught in the act. Sorry, not that sorry. And Mike Dunn returns for an A-Rod biogenesis crime doc called Screwball. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. You can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com, and you can become an official Blotter tipster at the Patreon page. That's patreon.com/blotterpresents. If you like the podcast, I would love it if you could tell a friend and rate it on iTunes so other listeners can find us. If you don't like the podcast, I would love it if you could keep that to yourself. Once again, my guest has been Stephanie Early Green. Thank you for laughing at that. She's on Twitter at @Ateffi. I am Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.